Welcome to the EI Podcast. I'm Jack Dickens, literary editor at Engelsberg Ideas. The Middle East continues to be a source of fascination and despair for observers in the West. From the ancient Persians to the post-Ottoman nation-states, these lands have been defined by a colourful cast of prophets and sultans, saints and soldiers, mystic poets and cruel potentates. More recently, many have sought to remake the region in their own image, from Arab nationalist projects to the Islamist tide that followed in the wake of the Iranian Revolution. Both the agonizing hope of the Arab Spring and the spectre of the ISIS Caliphate continue to cast long shadows. The region defies simple explanations. It is, we might say, a cauldron, where the fault lines of tribe, faith, and geopolitics generate both nihilistic conflicts and unexpected alliances. To discuss all this, I'm joined by the historian Simon Sebag Montefiore, who is the author of a remarkable new book, The Cauldron, The Making of the Modern Middle East. Simon, a warm welcome to the EI Podcast.
Lovely to be on. I've wanted to be on for a while. I'm an admirer of the whole Engelsberg project.
Simon, at the heart of your new book is the metaphor of a cauldron. Could you explain why you settled on this title for the book and why it captures the story that you wanted to tell?
Well, the good thing about the cauldron is that on one hand, it represents the metaphor of a bubbling, turbulent, dangerous, red-hot pot of different wars and conflicts and rival and feuding peoples and sects. But on the other hand, a cauldron can just be a pot of delicious soup full of delicious ingredients. And that is exactly the metaphor of the Middle East that I'm talking about. On one hand, you know, as we see at this very moment, it's filled with unsolved conflicts and hot wars. But on the other hand, you know, with a historian's perspective and also the perspective of someone who enjoys life and loves food and life and variety and diversity, the Middle East is an incredibly rich and enriching place and a wonderful culture, a wonderful history. The book is filled with poetry as well as battle plans. And that is the image of the cauldron, and that's why I chose it.
And the passages from Middle Eastern poets that begin the section, every section of the book, are one of the delights, actually, of reading it as a reader. What made you feel that it was vital to tell this story now? Is this a project that predated recent events in the Middle East, or is it something that's motivated by the current turmoil?
Yeah, that's a good question. But I wanted to say about the poetry, you know, I took real trouble with the poetry because, you know, it's something that sets the tone in a way that is unusual in a political book. And so I love the fact that it's got, you know, Arab poetry, pre-Islamic Arab poetry, Iranian, Persian poetry, Jewish, Hebrew poetry, and so on. So, yeah, the poetry is a kind of important message to signal the delights of the cauldron as well as its dangers. But the book came about in the last 3 years. And so it is a post-October 7th book, if that's what you're asking. And what happened was my American publisher, Knopf, after October 7th, they said to me, would I write a short history of Israel? And I said, I don't want to do that because some of your viewers might know that I've written before a book called Jerusalem, the Biography, which is a history of the Holy Land for 5,000 years. So I've done a history of Israel from the original Kingdom of Israel to the modern Republic of Israel. So I didn't want to do that. So I said, I don't want to do that. But what I'd love to do is to do a book called The Cauldron, The Making of the Modern Middle East. And at the time, they said they didn't want it. So I forgot about it. And then about a year later, which is about 2.5 years ago now, they said, you know, you mentioned The Cauldron, would you write it? And so this is the book. But, you know, obviously it's partly a reaction to the fact that Middle East is at the center, even more than usual, of all our consciousness. It's also at the center of a sort of decolonializing awakening, moral awakening. And it's also, with the war in Iran, it's, you know, absolutely front and center. And Iran is like super important in the book. But, you know, but so are many kind of lesser known peoples and, as you said, smaller countries. And that's one of the fun things. The book covers 19 countries, what are now 19 countries. And some of them, you know, are constantly in our thoughts, like Iran or Israel, or Turkey, perhaps. And others like Morocco or Oman, others of the peoples like the Druze or the Kurds appear less frequently in these sort of books. So I wanted to encompass all of them, and that was the plan.
It must be said that the book covers an extraordinary geographic expanse, as you said, including countries that aren't always covered in histories of the modern Middle East, whether that's Oman or Morocco or Sudan. But you begin your narrative at the turn of the 20th century in 1900. Your prologue opens with a campaign in the Arabian desert with Abdulaziz ibn Saud, who would later go on to found the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. I wondered whether you could just sketch out the landscape of the Middle East as it was back then and how it differed from the Middle East as we know it today.
Well, I mean, the reason why I chose that scene, most people bring in these books, histories of the Middle East, traditionally with sort of Sykes-Picot, Lloyd George, the fall of the Ottoman Empire. And I didn't, because the sort of reigning spirit of this book is that this is a region ruled by its people. And of course, there are major interventions. There are outside rulers and empires, whether the Ottomans count as an outside empire, but certainly the British and the French and the Italians, the Greeks, and all the way up to the Soviets and the Americans. But the reason why I started with this is to signal, like, this is about the Middle East. That's overwhelmingly the Arab world. And therefore, I begin with the most successful Arab statesman conqueror of the 20th century, King Abdulaziz of Saudi, the founder of Saudi Arabia. And much of the book is told through these characters, the sort of the nation makers of the Middle East, or the kingdom makers of the Middle East. But when it opens at that point, at the beginning of the 20th century, say 1900, most of the Middle East is ruled from Constantinople by the Sultan Abdulhamid II of the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottoman Empire has ruled the Middle East essentially since 1517, when the Ottoman Sultan Selim the Grim took down the Mamluk Empire that ruled it from Egypt, ruled the Levant from Egypt, and replaced it with the Ottoman Empire. And so from then on, the Ottomans ruled Egypt, much of North Africa, and all the way to the borders of Morocco. And they also ruled much of Arabia, including the two holy cities, Mecca and Medina. Then if you go north, they ruled Iraq and Syria, and of course, Turkey. And if you go south, they ruled what is now Israel and Jerusalem. So this was a colossal empire that at its height was extended from Budapest to Baghdad. But by 1900, it had lost most of its European possessions, and many of its Christian, overwhelmingly Christian subjects, who went on to found new countries like Serbia or Romania. So it became an Islamic empire, and Abdulhamid II was determined to recast the empire as an Islamic state. And so he emphasized himself not just as sultan, but as caliph, and as ruler of and guardian of the holy cities. And he started to use ethnic and sectarian tensions to promote that. And that meant repressing particularly his Christian subjects, who were over a million Armenians, getting on for half a million or a million Greeks, and then other Christian minorities like the Assyrians and the Maronites in Lebanon. And so so in 1900, Abdulhamid ruled much of what we think of as the Middle East today, and all the countries that we regard as the center of the Middle East. So it ruled Libya. It also ruled Syria, Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, and Iraq, and part of Saudi Arabia. So huge territories. In the middle of that was Egypt, one of the, you know, a very singular cosmopolitan civilization, all of its own. And that was a purportedly independent monarchy, but actually ruled by Britain. And then if you move east, there was also the center of Arabia was ruled by no one quite. And there were different families, different dynasties fighting for control. And the Saudi family had actually ruled the interior of Arabia for most of the 18th and 19th centuries, but they'd lost it to a family called the Rashidis. And so what happened in 1900 was that the young prince, Abdulaziz, an extraordinary character, had started to plot to retake his patrimony, his home, his inheritance, which had been lost. And of course, he succeeded in the next 30 years in doing that. And when they found oil there, it became one of the incredibly wealthy country. And it still is. And now, 125 years later, Saudi Arabia is one of the key powers and probably the leading Sunni Muslim power in the Middle East. And just to finish this picture, we're still going east. If you come to the eastern and southern coasts of Arabia in 1900, the British controlled the Trucial States, which and various protectorates. So they controlled most of Yemen, which they called Aden, and they controlled Oman and what is today UAE, all the way up the coast towards Kuwait. And that was all British. And the British ruled that directly from the Indian Raj, which of course was the jewel in the crown of the British Empire. And when I say directly, they had sort of political agents who supervised these kingdoms, these emirates. But the British never actually took control of these. They were self-ruling. And that is one of the reasons for their success right up to today. And then, of course, there's the huge independent power that wasn't part of the Ottoman Empire and wasn't really colonized, which was Persia, the Kingdom of Persia, the Empire of Persia.
At the beginning of the period that you describe, the European powers are beginning to encroach increasingly in Ottoman lands. They're starting to erode the power of the Sultan Caliphs in Istanbul. Can you just give us a sense of how that leads up to the partition of the Middle East following the First World War?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when we're looking at the period right at the beginning of the 20th century, we've just talked about the Ottomans and the British and how Persia was a large, independent, but disintegrating kingdom. But then if you move into North Africa, you have the French expanding as well. And the French already, since 1828, in fact, they'd started to colonize what became Algeria. And there were many French colonists, Coulon, who lived there. And the French had also added to that Tunisia. And they were now eyeing Morocco, which was still an independent kingdom, an independent sultanate. And so so France had a huge presence. And of course, if you go south into sub-Saharan Africa, both Britain and France dominated Africa and had vast empires. And the French actually had more of Africa territorially than the British did. So that's the picture. And it's just the end of the scramble for Africa when everyone was carving it up. There's one small touch which is interesting, which was that Egypt had its own empire, and that empire was Sudan. And in 1820, the ruler of Egypt had conquered Sudan as an empire, as particularly a source of slaves for the Egyptians. And so ironically, the Egyptians had started the scramble for Africa. and set it off, which is interesting. But anyway, so that was the picture at the beginning of the 20th century. And then, of course, World War One came. And by the time World War One started, the Ottoman Empire had fallen into the hands of the Young Turks, and particularly a faction of the Young Turks, led by Talat Pasha and his two comrades, Enver and Jamal. And they were incredibly tough, ultra-nationalists, who really embraced a sort of proto-Nazi Turkish supremacism. They were eugenicists, they believed in social Darwinism, and once they brought the Ottoman Empire into World War One, they found themselves under attack from Russia, from Britain in the Dardanelles, and in the struggle for survival, they blamed the Christians within the empire and embarked on a brutal genocide of Armenians, but also Greeks and Maronites and other Christian Assyrians and other Christian sects. And out of that, they lost the World War One. Though they were much more resilient than anyone expected. They defeated the British in several battles. And when they finally succumbed in 1918, the British and French and Americans, who were the ruling allies, who now had won the war, were pretty determined to punish the Turks, the Turkish Ottomans, for their war crimes. And therefore, they devised this huge dividing up of the Middle East. And it's an interesting moment because, of course, looking back, we can see that the British and French and Americans didn't really know exactly what they were doing. But there again, the Ottomans had 400 years to rule the Middle East, and they had ended up in what was essentially a genocide. So I guess one has to conclude here that it's not just Western powers that find the Middle East pretty difficult to govern. Anyway, their plan was to divide it up. So the French took what is Greater Syria. The British took Iraq and what is now Israel and Jordan, and they already had Egypt, of course, and they already had the states, Aden and Oman and the Trucial states. And they decided that they would give the heartland of what is now Turkey, half of it to the Greeks, who could found a new Byzantine Empire there. And they would keep Constantinople for themselves because it was a great world city. And they would give Eastern Turkey to the Kurds and the Armenians. And the Turks themselves would only get a little bit in the middle. And so the first thing that happened was that Mustafa Kemal Pasha, the most successful Ottoman commander of the war, really fascinating character who became known as Ataturk later, launched a rebellion against the empires to create a new state, the Turkish Republic, a new nationalism, the Turks, a Turkish nationalism. And he launched a war on everybody in all directions. He chucked the French out of Cilicia, he chucked the Armenians out, he chucked the Kurds out. And then he turned and defeated the Greeks in a massive war in 1922. And out of this brutal ethnic conflict, which ended with huge deportations, massacres of Greeks, burning cities, and the sort of purging of an entire ethnic group, the Greeks, from a place where they'd lived for several thousand years. Out of that came the Turkish Republic. But the British and French were more successful in the Levant, in the main part of the Middle East, where they managed to put down rebellions and keep their mandates, which was the new name for colonies, really. And they managed to keep these mandates. They've taken a lot of blame for what's happened since. But it's interesting because they actually only ruled them for just around 30 years. And out of those mandates came the modern states of the Middle East. And it's interesting because just as there'd never been a Turkish Republic or a country called Turkey, there'd been the Ottoman Empire, so the new states that emerged from the Ottoman Empire and from the British mandate, the British and French mandates, were also new countries that had never existed before. They had ancient names like Palestine, like Syria, like Lebanon, like Iraq, but they were new, and sometimes they've struggled to work coherently as states. But essentially, all of them really became fully independent in the 1940s after World War II, and that's when the sort of modern architecture of the Middle East really emerged. And then you can see how the flux of these ideas, because the British weren't really sure what to do in their new mandate of Palestine. And they had promised a Jewish homeland in Palestine, whatever that meant. So some people wanted that to be a state, and some people wanted just a Jewish presence there where Jews could go and live under an Arab king. And others were Jewish socialists who arrived there and bought small farms and wanted to be socialistic farmers in small communities. And as we know, that isn't how it turned out. But the British hoped that they would be able to give independence to a new state called Palestine, in which Jews could immigrate and live in a single binational state. But to give you an idea how fluctuating all these ideas were, in Syria, for example, the French wanted to create 5 or 6 new states, two for the Sunni Arabs, one for the Maronites, one for the Alawites, one for the Druze, and maybe one for the Kurds. So in the end, they decided not to. They just created 2, Lebanon and Syria. So you can see that all these states were new creations. And similarly, when Libya became independent, that too was a new creation. It had been formed out of 2 or 3 Turkish vilayets. Iraq was a new idea. That was formed out of 3 Ottoman vilayets. Algeria was formed by the French as an addition to the metropole itself of France, as a department of France. And so its shape, when it rebelled against the French in 1956 to 63, when it emerged as that entire entity, as an independent country, after a brutal war rebellion against the French. And then, of course, Morocco at the other end was an ancient country, and the French managed to take it over as a protectorate. And when it became independent, it became a kingdom under its ruling dynasty. So the whole modern Middle East emerged after World War II in the form of these new states, and some of them were the result of rebellions and ethnic wars, like Turkey and Israel. Their founding is kind of similar. And others arrived as fully formed new states created by Western statesmen like Syria and Iraq.
So a combination of war, local rebellions, and European imperial interests redraw the map of the Middle East and North Africa in this period. I think that touches nicely on what you said about flux, because there's another thread running through your narrative, and that's the notion of historical contingency in a way that is quite refreshing. There's a sense that multiple futures were available to contemporaries in the region, and that if different choices had been made at different times, the political configuration of the region could be completely different today. What are some of those alternative futures that might have emerged, and are any of those alternatives still viable today?
Yeah, I mean, a good example of this is, for example, Libya now is in the middle of a civil war. Well, Libya could be one country. It could also be 2. It could be Tripoli and Benghazi. And it may well break into 2 countries. And so that's one example of that. Another example would be Lebanon. Lebanon was an example, as the French created it, ultimately, after considering breaking it up into smaller ethnic sectarian entities. they decided to create what they called Greater Lebanon. And that was, to coin a phrase, or to use a rather well-known phrase, a one-state solution. And as you can see in this one-state solution, the idea was that it would be a multi-ethnic state, and there was a confessional division of power in which the Maronites were the presidents, the Sunnis were the prime ministers, the speakers were other sects, and there were certain numbers of MPs for the Druze and other peoples and sects and Shia and so on. And as you can see, that hasn't worked very well because the Hezbollah Shiite militia backed by Iran had in fact for many years captured the state for about 20, 25 years, and have degraded the state to the extent that it's bankrupt, impoverished, and chaotic, and it's trying to restore now its union and its integrity and its coherence. But if that doesn't succeed, Lebanon could ultimately split into sectarian entities. Similarly with Syria, the new president of Syria, who's a former ISIS emir, Ahmad al-Sharaa, is trying to create a united Syria, the idea that the French wanted. But if he fails, there's a danger that it could break up into those very entities that the French considered, which is an Alawite state around the Mediterranean coast, and then a Druze state in the south, and so on. So there are tons of examples of how all these countries could have turned out differently. In the case of Israel and the Palestinian Arabs, you know, there are so many moments when more sensible and actually more peaceful states could have been founded, particularly you know, in the 30s when the Jewish leader Ben-Gurion was discussing with the al-Husseini family ways that there could be a state called Judea and there could be an Arab state that would be much bigger, and they could have coexisted in some form. And obviously there were many peace plans, but the best of them were all involving King Abdullah of Jordan ruling the Palestinian Arab parts of Palestine and the Jews forming a new state that they were going to call either Judea or Israel. And so there are multitudinous possible deals there. But, you know, you see other possibilities too. For example, you know, the rise of ISIS after the Arab Spring. ISIS was an extremely spectacularly violent Islamist militia that tried to create a new state, Islamic state, that would encompass most of Syria and most of Iraq. And had that succeeded, the whole map of the Middle East would have been redrawn. And had its leaders, led by al-Baghdadi, not been such total psychopaths, exhibitionistic psychopaths, you know, no one would have bothered to stop them, I believe. And there would have been a huge new state in the Middle East, right in between what is Syria and Iraq today. And I do think that in the end, looking ahead, it's possible that many of these borders will be redrawn perhaps to better reflect, you know, the ethnic loyalties and divisions. But equally, these states could work better too if they used a federal program. And for example, Iraq now, and I don't want to hold out Iraq as a perfectly governed state, far from it. It's still dominated by the popular mobilization militias, which are Shia militias, many of them linked to Iran. But it has worked, allowing the Kurds in the north to have their own Kurdish autonomous zone, which they rule themselves. And maybe that is a way that Iraq can keep working as a state in the future. So there are many, many possibilities here, and that's before we even get to Iran.
Arab-Israeli conflict looms large in the narrative. Why, in your view, has this proven to be so central and so intractable an issue in the modern Middle East?
I think it's I think in some ways it looms larger than other other issues, and in other ways it's actually a minor it's a relatively minor ethnic crisis within a state that is pretty similar to the kind of ethnic rivalries and strife and conflicts that you see in many of these states. So Israel is unique in many ways. Some of them due to the idiosyncratic nature of Jewish history itself. But in other ways, it's a typical post-Ottoman state in the Middle East today. But it is intractable. And the reason it's intractable is because the Holy Land, the reason it's so important is in part because the Holy Land is so important in Western consciousness. But obviously, if you compare it to what happened in the formation of Turkey in 1922-23, the wars between Iran and Iraq, for example, or the war with America and Iraq, or America and Iran, it's a pretty tiny conflict and a tiny issue. Or it was until the tragedy of Gaza on October 7th. But the reason why it's so intractable is partly because both sides ultimately have failed to come to a compromise that is workable. And maybe they never will, or maybe they will, because the idea of a possible compromise is actually quite feasible if a large enough constituency in each nation agreed to it. But part of it is made a lot worse by the fact that the Israeli state was created and the Palestinians failed to create their state in 1948, so soon after the Arab powers became independent. And so its effect was that the Arab nations of the Arab League began their independent life with a massive military defeat and humiliation. And therefore, they blamed that on the Israeli state, and they used the Palestinian Arab people, the 750,000 refugees, half of them who had fled, half of them who had been driven out by the Israelis, but they used them as a political pawn and prevented their ever settling anywhere. And that was a project that was supported by the international community with the United Nations, forming a United Nations special UNRWA, special charity, philanthropic organization to protect, but also in effect to preserve the refugee status of the Palestinians. So that's one part of it. But another part of it is, of course, Palestine, Israel is a very small space to have two countries in it, even if the creation of those countries was a simple matter, which it isn't. And that's part of it. And I believe that a future two-state solution, and I'm very keen on a Palestinian state somehow, but I think it would work better if there was some sort of federal relationship between the Palestinian entity and a larger Arab state nearby, maybe Jordan. But the real reason for its intractability, the other real reason for its intractability and its status in the West is that the Holy Land is a cultural religious obsession in the West and remains so to this day. And that explains a lot of the reasons why it is such a massive issue today among Western activists.
There's a great line from the Israeli diplomat and politician, which you cite in the book, and in which he says that Palestinian leaders never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. But you argue that this could equally be true of Israeli leaders over the last 40 or 50 years.
Yeah, I think they both have to be blamed for the failures of this. And, you know, you would just have to remember that there was like 20 years, 25 years when a majority of both peoples wanted to find a compromise and believed in a negotiated settlement. And there were always extremists on both sides who wanted to kill people to stop it happening. But ultimately, there's really no choice to that plan. But both sides would have to recognize the other's integrity, historical narrative, and existence as a nation. But, you know, that came close to happening in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, and it could happen again. But one has to recognize that after October the 7th, the unbearable slaughter and rapine committed by Hamas on Israeli civilians, and after Israel's ferocious war against Hamas in Gaza, in which tens of thousands of Palestinian civilians were killed. After both these occasions, both countries, both nations are deeply traumatized, enraged, and it will take a long time before they recover.
I think that gets to the heart of another crucial narrative arc that you trace in the book, and that is the rise and fall of secular nationalism, whether that's the Arab nationalism of Nasser or the Iranian and Turkish nationalisms of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi or Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, and its displacement in the 1970s by a new form of revolutionary Islamism. What caused this displacement, and was it inevitable?
I think it was probably inevitable, because pan-Arab nationalism, which was championed by Gamal Abdel Nasser, was at its height, incredibly successful, and looked incredibly successful. And Gamal Abdel Nasser was able in 1956 to take control of the Suez Canal, throw out the British. In 1958, he united Syria and Egypt into one country. And it looked like he was unstoppable. But in fact, he overreached. He overreached and really established a police state in Egypt. The Syrians threw him out. There was a civil war in Yemen in which he launched a sort of quasi-colonial war using poison gas and massive numbers of troops to try and suppress the Yemenis. And ultimately, he was forced into a position where he began to talk very, very aggressively about the destruction of Israel. And that led to the Six-Day War, in which the Arab forces were again roundly defeated in 6 days. And that sort of defeat again led to the collapse of that vision of pan-Arabism. But it took 10 years for a real replacement to emerge. And when it did, it was the 1979 Iranian Revolution, Iranian Islamic Revolution, that provided a narrative and a replacement that co-opted some features of Arab nationalism, but into an Islamist manifestation of it. And this was an anti-Western, resistance, radical Islamism that was initially took power in Iran, and Iran is a Shiite country, of course, but it also caused a Sunni version of its radicalism to thrive and surge across the region. And we still see that today, not only in Iran, but in its allies, its militia allies, Hezbollah and Hamas, the Iraqi militias and the Houthis, of course. And as we speak, part of that is playing out in Yemen, where Saudi Arabia, that represents the opposite approach to Islam, is leading a war now to destroy the Houthis that may lead to the collapse of the Houthi regime, or at least their retreat to their mountainous redoubts. So this battle for the heart of Islam is going on right now. And in part, it reflects the wider battle on the planetary struggle between the open world represented by America, the closed world represented by Russia, China, and Iran. And in a smaller Middle Eastern regional version, it's a battle, it's partly a battle for access to the Strait of Hormuz now. it's partly a battle for existential survival for it by Israel. It's partly also a battle within this house of Islam, between the two versions of Islam, the sort of the version of Islam that's open to the West, and the version of Islam that is absolutely dedicated to resistance and destruction of the West and Western friends and allies and Israel in the Middle East. And we need the open version to win.
And you cite the Lebanese scholar Nadim Shehadi in your concluding essay, saying that we've misunderstood the struggle of ideas in the West, that we see it as a struggle between Islam and secularism, when really it is between liberal and radical forms of Islam. Can you just say, you've touched upon what is at stake in the struggle, but what could we do in the West as Western publics and policymakers to try and influence this struggle in our favour? What are the kinds of policies that we should be implementing to try and make sure that the liberal version, the tolerant cosmopolitan tradition of Islam, triumphs over that which is intolerant and violent?
Well, part of it is helping militarily those powers that represent this view. And by the way, you know, it's very fashionable amongst decolonializer, anti-imperialist activists to obsess about the wonders of the resistance fighters and militias, and even Iran, even the blood-spattered regime of Iran, and to denounce declaim against the pro-Western regimes, many of which are absolute monarchies or autocracies as well. But actually, you know, the open version of Islam is an ancient version of Islam from the very beginning of Islam, pretty much from the Umayyad Empire in Damascus, from the Abbasid Empire that ruled the whole Arab Empire from Baghdad. And, you know, so this is a strong strain that goes right the way through Islam, right the way through to modern times, in which Islam is always present in societies and always important and always revered and respected and lived, but doesn't always control the way people live in private, doesn't always control the state, doesn't always repress minorities. And so both these versions of Islam represent strains of Islam through the history. And so, you know, we need to back the ones that we need to win. And there are ways to do this. I think a sort of interesting example is, a bad example was the Gulf War, where we invaded Iran and found ourselves facing an insurgency that the American invasion had partly unleashed. And that obviously was a bad way to do this. And a good example is the campaign against ISIS, where the Americans and the West provided air power, but the fighting was done by Kurdish and other militias, and they defeated ISIS pretty soundly. So there's bad news, but there's also good news about how this will work. But in our own societies, we need to be super careful about protecting Islamist ideas that are actually a threat to our open societies. And that's the big challenge. The big challenge is to embrace and welcome immigrants and their enriching cultures, and at the same time to clearly identify those that are inimical to our rights, to our liberal democracy, and not to back those. And that has been a challenge that I think, you know, the British government, the French government are struggling with, to the disgust of the Emiratis, for example, who said, you know, we don't even want our children to study in British universities because Britain is a hotbed of Islamism. So there are lessons to learn from the Arab world itself.
And finally, do you think we need to rethink the notion of the Middle East as a coherent geopolitical entity? And could you explain why?
Yeah, I think we do. I think what we're seeing now, in a to put it very quickly, is the Middle East is now seeing the convergence of many theaters. And so you have, if you look at what's happening, for example, in Arabia right at this moment, you have Pakistani troops there, you have Israeli troops in UAE, you have Ukrainian advisors, you have multiple outside powers now involved. If you look at what's happening in East Africa and Sudan, there are 12 powers fighting in Sudan now, backing different factions. You can see that, Saudi Arabia and Turkey move closer to Pakistan, India moves closer to Israel, as Turkey and Greece face off in the Eastern Mediterranean, Israel is getting closer to Greece. In other words, what we see here is a convergence of theaters that really expands what used to be called the Middle East from South Europe all the way to South Asia. And we need a new word for that. And I think none of the words we've got so far really catch it. The SWANA, but that doesn't really capture East Africa or South Europe. There's West Asia, but that doesn't mention Africa. So I suggested various ideas, and perhaps one could finish by saying that, one of the fun things about this turbulent period and slightly terrifying period of instability that we're seeing is the game of trying to coin new acronyms to describe what's happening. So I suggested SEMASTIA, which would be Southeast Europe, Middle East, West Asia, East Africa. But I'm sure some of your listeners can do better.
We'll be sure to hold a poll and we'll let you know what the results are. Simon, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks for having me. Really nice to see you.
Lovely to see you as well. Simon's book, The Cauldron, The Making of the Modern Middle East, is available to buy now. And having read it, I can say that it is, without a doubt, the best single volume narrative history of the modern Middle East that I have come across. So if you want to understand the region, I heartily recommend it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the EI podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please sign up to our mailing list and download the Engelsberg Ideas app. Explore intelligent perspectives on history, culture, and geopolitics anytime, anywhere. And best of all, it's totally free. Until next time, thanks for listening.